Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 24th of June. This press release was released on June 22nd, and it is from the Committee to Protect Journalists, calling on Iranian authorities to release all journalists detained in the aftermath of the disputed presidential election and to lift the onerous press restrictions that are choking information at a time when the country and the world most need it. At least 13 journalists detained during a week of protests were still in government custody as of 2 days ago, including a veteran Newsweek correspondent. The massive media crackdown continued into its second week. Many journalists have gone into hiding in anticipation of arrest. Authorities instructed the BBC's bureau chief to leave the country. The signals of the BBC and U.S. government-backed radio and television stations remained jammed. The government shut the Tehran offices of a major Arab satellite station indefinitely. Newspaper censorship widespread. Joining us this hour to talk about the difficulties of getting news and why journalists have been detained and all of those issues, we have two guests with us. One is from the Committee to Protect Journalists. Mohammed Abdul Dayem is Middle East and North Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Mohammed, thank you very much for joining us today. Hello, Mohammed.
Thank you for having me.
There you are. Hi. Thanks very much for being with us. And Mehdi Samati is with us, Associate Professor in the Department of Communication Studies at Eastern Illinois University, Editor of Media, Culture, and Society in Iran, Living with Globalization and the Islamic State. Professor Samati, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
What kind of updates do we have since that press release came out? How many journalists are in detention? How many have been deported? And also the extent of the crackdown on news. Mohammed, you want to start?
Yeah, I'm sorry to report, actually, that that number has gone up significantly. There are about 40 journalists and media workers that are currently being held. And the breakdown of that number is 18 journalists whose names we've confirmed and are definitely in detention right now, as well as about 25 employees of one specific newspaper called Kalame Sabz, which is owned by the defeated presidential candidate, Mir Hossein Mousavi. Oh. Those 25 or so employees were rounded up en masse on Monday evening when they went to the office to pick up their paychecks. Plainclothes police officers showed up and took the whole bunch. So we're not really clear how many of those 25 employees are actual journalists or media workers or simply the office sort of support people. But the total number at this point is around 40. It's like 42, 43, somewhere in that neighborhood. And unfortunately, we can't confirm any more than that because, obviously, of all the restrictions the Iranian government has put in place.
And do you know where they're being held, what their conditions are?
We only know where about a handful are being held out of the 40 or so.
Mm-hmm. Professor Samati, this obviously makes it extremely difficult to get news, and I noticed that NPR is watching Iranian state television to get news, which certainly has a particular kind of slant. That's not the way to get the whole truth, is it?
No. As you may know, in Iran, broadcasting is controlled by the state under the supervision of the Office of the Supreme Leader. So what we get is basically the official news, sometimes we call official media, official culture in Iran. Over the past few weeks, their performance has been basically dreadful. They are, as much as they could, they have avoided showing any signs of the protests taking place. And when they have mentioned them, it's been usually in the context of vilifying them as rioters and recently, you know, as individuals who've been tricked by Western media to take onto the streets and demonstrate. So they don't have a good record and they can't be, valid source of information, but they do, their coverage is important in the sense that it reflects what the current leadership of the Supreme Office of the Supreme Leader thinks, and also the general outline of the, you know, sort of the discourses of the state about, or the government about where things stand and how they see things. So on that note, it's useful. And occasionally also they have to, admit what's taking place. So, for example, the case of this young woman who was killed.
What a horrible story.
Yeah, and they had to admit it. And, of course, for a while there was a little bit of an attempt by the state to say that this was staged all by, foreign media. And only on those, in that particular framework, we can sort of have put some value on what the state TV is saying. But there are other sources of, information, as you know, in Iran, that outside of the framework of the broadcasting. And but right now, as this is your topic of, conversation today, there's a lot of restraints, on what can be gathered in Iran today.
Mm-hmm. The society, the Committee to Protect Journalists, has said if you detain journalists for reporting news and commentary, it indicates that the government has something to hide. I guess that would be what we all think. Why restrict the flow of the press?
Well, that is certainly true. The current a disputed an election, some would say stolen election. Early on, I wrote somewhere that if the government didn't really think had a good position to defend, they probably wouldn't go through this length of, arresting journalists and other politicians of the reform camp and intellectuals. So certainly, it appears that they're operating from a defensive position, and on that note. Probably, are not in a position to defend their positions and arguments and points of views.
I was reading today that Mousavi is evidently under arrest as well. Where would that kind of news come from?
Well, right now, what we've had are forms of, citizen journalism, sometimes are called. And in other forms, we've had individuals associated with, say, the reformist camp who, through either Facebook or basically calling those with access to outside world, to email, and good old landline telephone lines still in our work, and people get the word out in those forms. So that's one thing that I thought you'll talk about today is
yes.
There are there are limits to the power of the state and or the government to restrict information from flowing out or circulating in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly this is one case where, for example, Mousavi has been the camp of Mr. Mousavi, the main opposition candidate. They have been posting statements by Mr. Mousavi on their Facebook page, which I visit regularly. And his wife also has, Ms. Zahra Rahnavard. She has been very active in the campaign, and she also has a page where she posts things, So Facebook has been one channel of, communication to the outside world. And people are calling from Tehran to, for example, BBC Persian, BBC Persian language television, and some information is getting out that way. Other places such as there is the Voice of America, a Persian news network channel that people call in. So those are some of the channels through which we get some information out of Iran.
Mm-hmm. I have heard that those channels have been jammed.
Yes. The BBC especially was vulnerable in that it appears that they had not anticipated that they would be jammed during this election season. And since then, they have, I think, are fortifying the signals through other satellites, but they are jammed, and access to them is sporadic. I listen to them, And callers, you know, complain that in some parts of Tehran you can get them, and some others you can't, and it's sporadic. It comes in and goes out. And but what they've done, they also made their program available as audio, and so as in radio program. And so people have access to that. The Voice of America network has, I think they probably anticipated this, in that I think they have multiple sources of, you know, sort of sending the signal to Iran, so they couldn't jam it as much as they could jam BBC. But there are, yes, there are some restrictions. I've even heard that they, in some, I heard from two people, though this hasn't been done on a large scale, but in some areas they've even started collecting satellite dishes. But as I said, that was that seemed to be very rare and not, you know, something that the state can do. It's, you know, many people in Tehran own satellite dishes, and collecting them by force would be a massive undertaking that the state wouldn't want to do right now.
Mm-hmm. Professor Somani, if most of the news that people were getting, if, unless they are activating Facebook and going through these other means, if they're looking at state television, which is becoming increasingly warning of, you know, don't be in opposition here. We will never give in to the pressure. Demonstrations are outlawed, et cetera. Does that have the effect, because you don't have a wide source of other information, to make people nervous? And we've heard that demonstrations are down somewhat in the last couple of days. People are just staying home?
No, actually, I don't think that's accurate. In Iran, we've always had the state television and broadcasting, you know, IRIB, Islamic Republic, you know, broadcasting. It's a massive organization, and they have internal and external programming, multiple channels, and they have, you know, highly popular entertainment programs. Yet, we've always had these what you could call alternative sources of information and media in Iran, satellite, you know, television. We have about somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 Persian language satellite channels that are to Iran. We have most people have, you know, for a nominal fee, you get a satellite dish. Someone comes to your house, and they themselves call it breaking the code on it. You know, they basically scramble a card in there somewhere. You start, and then after that, without paying a subscription fee, you'll get you know, hundreds of channels. From which you could also then pick BBC, Bloomberg, CNN, and a host of other television channels. Of course, the problem is not everybody speaks English, but that's part of their media diet. We also have, of course, internet. Yes, they filter websites, but a lot of young people know how to get around those filters, either through software or through what they call proxy server. So young people know how to get around those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an information-rich environment, despite, you know, the government's best efforts. On that note, people aren't, you know, people, I mean, most people have CNN in their living room. They have BBC, you know. Even right now, with the jamming, they can't jam everything. It's just, you know, much like they can't shut down the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So people, you know, are not starved for information. One thing that has been clear to me, I think, you know, one entity that's been really damaged in all this is the broadcasting, you know, entity that's owned and operated by the state. Because people have, it's become essentially something that people can point their anger toward, because they can see for themselves that has not been, you know, the broadcasting has not been even handed at all, and further, you could see these past couple of days, or past couple of actually, maybe past 4 or 5 days, there's been an attention paid to broadcasting in Iran by sometimes the very conservative elements within the government, because they see how it has angered people, mm-hmm. Through this heavy-handed support of Mr. Ahmadinejad, and so on that, you know, on that note, we've come to a point where people, I think, you know, for the most part, know propaganda when they see it, and they tune it out. But they do have other sources of information. If the protests have died down, I don't think it's because they're starved for information. Yes, it's unfortunate that this lack of communication between Master Mousavi and other reformist, individuals, they don't have, say, something as widely disseminated as, say, you know, a piece of broadcast news. But I don't think the slowing down of the protests, you know, has to do that much with not having a leader, not having information. Those are factors. But I think at the moment, that probably is more of a function of uncertainty,
mm-hmm.
that the opposition itself is having, you know, about how to proceed, because
right.
They are faced with this brutal crackdown,
mm-hmm.
and in fact, even yesterday, the Revolutionary Guard and other security apparatus, you know, in the state announced that they were going to even ratchet it up and not going to tolerate it. I think the leadership of the opposition right now, to the extent that you can say it has an opposition and it's a uniform sort of or unified movement, I don't think you can call it that. They themselves are contemplating, you know, they are thinking, you know, they're weighing their options, and different individuals are saying different things. So it's more a function of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to go anywhere. It's not going to get resolved anytime soon. And so we're seeing that, not necessarily that people don't know what to do because they have their stock for information.
Mohammed, how are you getting your information?
Some sources inside Iran, mostly journalists, with whom we communicate through the variety of means, and I'd rather not go into more detail about that and sort of tip the authorities off as to how we communicate with those people. But suffice it to say, there's a handful of ways to talk to people, either online or on the phone or through email or through a third party. So there's really no shortage of ways to contact people if you really want to. And that really ties into what your other guest was saying earlier. The government is trying to accomplish two things by sort of stopping the flow of information. They're trying to stop the outside world from learning what's going on inside Iran, but also they're trying to stop the Iranian people from learning what's going on inside Iran and how the outside world is reacting. And to a degree, they've succeeded in that first goal, but they've failed miserably in the second goal. Like your previous guest said, people have the internet, people have satellite dishes, and those satellite dishes, once people crack the code, which is virtually everyone that has a satellite dish, you know, like tens of millions of households, they have Farsi news, they have English language news, they have German and French news broadcasting from Europe. Those stations also have a Farsi broadcast, they have an Arabic broadcast. They have access to the Arabic channels. Some people do speak Arabic. In other words, there's an endless supply of information, and the state can only block so many sources. The state can only jam so many sources. Even when they jam the BBC or Voice of America or any of these other sources, those broadcasters, they just switch their frequency. And listeners don't need to know what frequency they've switched to. They just turn their dial until they find it.
Oh,
and so the government literally has a minder sitting there trying to track these guys down. mm-hmm. in real time, and they've lost that game. I think they realize that too. They may not admit it, but they've lost that game, and they've lost that game online as well. People repost things, people retweet, people use proxy servers, and then that's just the nature of 21st century technology. Is it's so quick, it gets updated on almost a daily basis, and no state, not just the Iranian state, I don't think any state, including the Chinese state, for example, which has devoted numerous resources to controlling their blogosphere and their internet, it's a losing proposition, and they can try, but they've yet to succeed.
We welcome phone calls. Mohammed is with us for just a few more minutes, so if you want to direct questions to him, I would suggest you call in right now. Mehdi Samati is staying with us for the full hour. We're talking about Iran and information, what kinds of information being blocked, the number of journalists who have been detained, arrested, the number of journalists who have been kicked out of the country, and how we're getting information. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our lines are open to you right now, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Let's talk, Mohammed, before you have to leave, a little bit more about what the Committee to Protect Journalists is doing and can do in Iran to protect journalists.
Obviously, I think one very important thing is to keep track of the journalists who are being detained, who are being harassed or beaten up or otherwise intimidated, to keep track of journalists, the foreign journalists who are being thrown out. So that's one aspect of what we do, and a very important one, especially when the government is trying to control the flow of information. Another thing is we advocate on behalf of those journalists, directly with the Iranian government, which may not be the most receptive party at this point, and we understand that, but that doesn't necessarily dissuade us from talking to them and for calling on them to respect, you know, their own laws. And also, you know, basic principles of international law to which they are a party by virtue of the fact that they've signed a number of international treaties that require them to treat civilians, journalists are civilians, in a certain way. And so we do that, and we also engage other governments that have relations with the diplomatic relations with the Iranian government to put pressure on them. That would include European governments, that would include the Japanese government and governments, frankly, throughout the world who have much more robust diplomatic and trade relations with Iran that perhaps the U.S. doesn't have because those two countries have not had diplomatic representation for nearly 30 years.
Mm-hmm. And is that, do you see any signs of success there?
Well, it's an incremental process, and I'm hesitant to speak too soon. At this point, very few journalists have been released. In fact, the only journalists that have been released were ones that were rounded up on the street as they were filming or as they were interviewing people. And those people were usually detained for a couple of hours, 3-4 hours at the most, have had their equipment confiscated, and were usually held for a few hours and released and then asked to leave the country. Those were mostly foreign journalists that were in Iran on a one-week visa to report on the elections. But we are not aware of a single journalist who's sort of was rounded up from their home or their office that has been released. So the answer is no one has that's been arrested has been released yet. But that doesn't mean that they won't be. After all, the Iranian government can't, and I don't think they plan to hold these people indefinitely. And eventually, they have to charge them with a recognized crime under Iranian law, or they have to let them go. Again, they're partially achieving their goal of controlling the flow of information, but they're doing that at a very high cost. It's a very high cost politically, both in terms of external relations with other countries, but also internally. It is seriously undermining the regime's credibility in the eyes of its people. And Iran now holds the dishonor, in fact, of being the world's leading jailer of journalists. Up till 2 weeks ago, was China with 28, I think, roughly 30 journalists in prison. Iran, now a country much, much smaller, obviously, is jailing 40 plus journalists and media workers, and that is something that the people of Iran are aware of and will remember for a long time to come. So this does come at a very heavy price, and I think the Iranian regime realizes that.
All right. One call for you, and then we'll let you go. Brad from Appleton. Hi.
Hi, yes. Mohammed, I wanted to ask, I've been following on Twitter. I was on Sunday night following what was going on with Nadia, and a lot of the people were saying that they suggested to change their location and their time zones. I was curious as to why they would ask to do that.
Well, thank you for your question. I believe that a lot of people on Twitter have been asking users that are outside Iran to change their profile or their settings to a Tehran timestamp, and essentially that's to make it more difficult for the authorities who are trying to track down people who are sending tweets from inside Iran, making it more difficult for the government to find those. Let's say, and this is a hypothetical, let's say there's 100 people inside Iran sending messages, and there are people in the government that are online trying to track those people down. There's only 100 people inside Iran. It's relatively easy to track them down. But if then another 1,000 people all over the world change their timestamp to Tehran, then they've got 1,100 people to sort through, only 100 of whom are actually inside Iran. So this is one way of trying to confuse the authorities. Unfortunately, the negative side effect of that is that it also becomes more difficult for people who are following the news or people like us who are tracking news coming out of Iran. It makes it more difficult for us to confirm whether or not certain information is indeed coming from inside Iran. But like all emerging technology, it always has a positive and a negative flip side. And that's just the name of the game, and people will, you know, both we and the government and purveyors of the news and people who consume the news will just have to deal with that. That's the reality on the ground today.
Mm-hmm. Mohammed, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Yeah. We continue our conversation. Professor Mehdi Samati is staying with us, Associate Professor, Department of Communication Studies at Eastern Illinois University and Editor of Media, Culture, and Society in Iran, Living with Globalization and the Islamic State. Talking about communication, the crackdown on journalists, more journalists now having been detained than anywhere. It's the leading detainer of journalists, as you heard Mohammed just say. We're welcoming phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is the number if you'd like to send an email. It's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Samati, can you tell me what difficulties journalists were facing in terms of accurately reporting the election returns? How hard was it to get to the truth there?
Well, one of the reasons that the election results are suspect is not simply because journalists weren't present, but that even observers from, say, the reformist camp were not present when these the tabulations and the counting and all the rest, you know, took place. And so it all happened, you know, away from the eyes of, you know, any journalists and even observers that are supposed to be there and observing, you know, how this is all, you know, shaping up. And so by essentially denying, you know, not just journalists but others, any access, They thought they could, you know, roll this out according to their own script, their own narrative. So it's, you know, I should add that before the election, you know, in Iran we have the even though the broadcasting is under the control of the state, print press is a commercial operation. Now that means you have to apply for a license, you know, to operate, to have, you know, a newspaper, and so there's always been we've had always this very lively press scene where various newspapers, you know, prop up and they get shut down because they cross the proverbial red line with the state, and then the same leadership of the same editorial team, anyway, will reconstitute the paper under another name. So we've had this lively press up to, you know, during normal time, and by that I mean when we don't have elections coming up. Now, with this election, what's very interesting about it is that even the state TV, I mean, the state TV was by and large ignoring the election, and they had this, what you could call sort of a permanent campaign for Mr. Ahmadinejad, the incumbent president, but they were basically ignoring it up until about a month before the election. All of a sudden, it was as if they somehow didn't expect this, you know, people would stay home, wouldn't be interested in voting, and that because they have been pumping up, you know, the rhetoric and the imagery and the narrative about the success stories of the present administration, and that people would basically not show up, and then we have a what would look like, you know, a foregone conclusion. But things changed. In Iran, first of all, what was very interesting this time around was for the first time we had live presidential debates. So the discourse of, you know, even broadcasting system is not as monolithic as, you know, one would think. I mean, for example, during at a time when Nasser Ahmadinejad was attracting, you know, attention for statements he was making about the Holocaust, you know, regrettably, you know, all of those statements made, Iranian TV was broadcasting a very popular historical drama about victims of the Holocaust, you know, and
oh, really?
Yes, and it was a highly, you know, entertaining program and popular, you know. So it's not always monolithic. However, this time around, with once the election, you know, for some reason, I think they just wanted to jazz it up a little. Perhaps they decided to have these live debates. What they didn't anticipate, you know, there are a number of things that actually coalesced to make this, you know, where we are today. For example, Mr. Ahmadinejad basically performed in a way that was rabble-rousing, you know, you could say, by throwing wild accusations at, you know, just about everybody other than his own administration, people who are the pillar of the Islamic Revolution for the past 30 years, you know, three administrations, you know, prior to him, you know, of three, you know, the prime minister's time, Mr. Mousavi, then Rafsanjani's, you know, period, and then Mr. Khatami's period. All that, basically, that's the entire 30-year, you know, history, excluding the 4 years of Mr. Ahmadinejad's time. And he questioned all that. So these electrifying debates live on television, these really, you could, you know, this was unprecedented. So that was part of the reason. The other, I think, sometime during this after the second debate, Mr. Mousavi's campaign was gathering momentum. His wife electrified, you know, the crowds, and women flocked to his campaign. Very, very smart, young, you know, sophisticated young people running his campaign. Of course, Mr. Mousavi himself, you know, is not a good public speaker. That helped him actually with audiences. He was a sympathetic figure, and in a way, he kind of upset Mr. Ahmadinejad's populist rhetoric by being, you know, kind of, you know, he speaks in a sort of a simple language, and all these things coalesced, and people, you know, people saw an opportunity, and then we had this, you know, massive turnout, and the state wasn't expecting it, in my judgment, and it got, you know, was surprised by the turnout, and, you know, by any measure, we have, you know, one of the best, even by Western liberal democracy standards, such turnout is you know, very exceptional. You know, over 80% of the eligible voters, you know, participated in the election. So now it should be noted that once we had these televised debates, things started, you know, going wrong for the state and its broadcasting outlets. By then, people had already, you know, figured out that there are other, you know, channels of communication. So we sort of have to look at the internet and the sort of what I call the global communication circuitry, you know, as a part of this scene, as a network in the background, where images, you know, people, maybe we have, you know, in a minute, you know, I have time to talk, address this. In Iran, basically, we have a very young population, 70% of the population is under the age of 30, with high literacy rate, almost near universal in urban areas. We have close to 67% of the country, you know, urbanized, and women are very much part of the workforce and very active, you know, and we have an information-rich society. All these things mean that we have a population that has experienced forms of civil society, yet we have political institutions and structures that don't accommodate, you know, the kinds of things that such an urban, such an illiterate and sophisticated population demands. So we, at one point or another, you're going to have this. And I think election, it, you know, right now, even though it's been about the election results and nullifying the results and having, you know, another election, but ultimately this isn't just about the election. It's something larger, something bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had for a long time, if you know, for those who follow these things, I'm working on another book on popular culture in Iran. We have, you know, a very active, dynamic underground culture in Iran. It's called underground because rap music, for example, is illegal. Rock and roll is illegal. The state, you know, doesn't allow it. You know, young people don't have permits, and they're not given permits to have to hold concerts outside. So they do it online. They do it underground. And so we have in Iran, this is the paradox of the Islamic Revolution, you know, after 30 years, we've had Islamization efforts by the government, by the state, yet we have more and more a secular popular culture and a secular private life away from the eyes of the state. So we basically have two cultures, two media systems, two everything.
Hmm.
And so people in public have to behave a particular way. By the way, I shouldn't say there's. It doesn't mean we don't have religiosity in Iran. It doesn't mean also that everybody is, you know, listening to rap or everybody is a rock and roller or a metalhead, as we say. it's not the case. But increasingly, the political structures and processes and institutions, you know, and entities are like too tight for, you know, this. Introductory chapter to my book, which came out well before, you know, the elections,
mm-hmm.
Says, you know, toward the end that we have this cultural dynamism in Iran that is basically is going to determine its future. So it's the failure of the state and the authorities to realize that
mm-hmm.
that's gotten them where they are today.
Let's go to more phone calls. Marilyn is next from Cleveland, Wisconsin. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. I'm a little disturbed because it seems to me there's a rush to judgment here. The assumption that marchers in Tehran and bloggers and Twitters represent the millions of Iranians. The program right here on your station by Joe Klein, who went outside of Tehran into the rest of Iran, said that Ahmadinejad is greatly admired by the poorer classes for the help that he has received, or at least they perceive he has sent them. And polls taken before the election showed Ahmadinejad receiving a vast majority of the votes. I'm not at all sure that these protesters don't just represent the more elite parts of Iran.
Professor Samanti.
Yes. Thank you very much for the question. You have a valid point in that we should not, as I said, think that everybody in Iran, you know, is on internet and or a blogger or Twitter and all that. That's not accurate at all. However, the poll that your caller is referring to was taken well before the presidential campaign took off. So those numbers don't really reflect the changed for the toward the last 3 weeks of the campaign. And yes, at the beginning actually of the campaign, there was Mr. Musavi's campaign was by every measure pretty lackluster. We didn't think I personally didn't think it was going to go anywhere. But things changed. And the other issue, yes, Ahmadinejad has a base, much like, think of it in these terms. It's a crude analogy, but it's a parallel. Nonetheless, it could help explain. Think about when President George W. Bush left office. He still held on to his, base, and he was very popular despite, many, what some would characterize as failures in domestic and international policies. He still was very popular with his base. Mr. Ahmadinejad has a base. However, I am, sort of reading the current literature on this from anthropologists and political scientists and sociologists from Iran who have basically been digging into this notion that somehow the basis for support for Mr. Mousavi. By the way, we should say, yes, we should, in deference to, a finer point here, we should say that those who take it to the streets to protest and throw rocks and all that, those would be different from the wider base of support for Mr. Mousavi. On one day, 3 million people showed up on the streets. I don't think, and reading the research, the latest research I'm referring to, the support for a reformist candidate cuts across all class categories, age groups, region, and even within the military paramilitary, within Revolutionary Guard, not necessarily the Basijis, there is support for Mr. Mousavi. So it's not increasingly people are paying attention to this. I mean, if you don't even have to be a social scientist, you just if you go online, there's all these images of the marches and the rallies and the protests. If you just look at those, you see people, the war veterans among them. You see old men, old women. You see people from rural areas, from urban areas. So I don't think that's necessarily the case. Somehow we're looking at few people. Yes, not everybody, AR should make one thing clear. Yes, only about 30% of the population has access to Internet. However, since we have a very young, population, the voice of the 30, percent become significant.
Mm-hmm. We need to pause for a moment. In return, our guest is Professor Mehdi Samati, Associate Professor, Department of Communication Studies, Eastern Illinois University, and Editor of Media, Culture, and Society in Iran, Living with Globalization and the Islamic State. Thanks very much, Marilyn, for your call. We have time for a couple more phone calls if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, the Southwest Wisconsin farm, made famous by Ben Logan in his book, The Land Remembers, is going to be protected and preserved for agricultural use. He has given it to the Mississippi Valley Conservancy. Ben Logan will be joining us for part of the 10 o'clock hour, as will Tim Jacobson, who's executive director of the Mississippi Valley Conservancy. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, and we do have time to take a couple more of your phone calls. Professor Samati, I'm wondering if you can imagine having Ahmadinejad as Iran's president for the next 4 years.
Yes. I think at this point, it looks like he will be the next president. However, Iranian politics is very much unpredictable at this stage because the way things have turned out. Basically, since last Friday, when the Supreme Leader essentially threw all his weight behind Mr. Ahmadinejad, it has, I think, brought the whole, what they themselves call the system, the Islamic Republic as a whole, under question mark. We have passed the threshold, and it can't sustain itself. The state either has to go more and more toward sort of a religious dictatorship of a very, you know, harsh type, or it's going to have to rethink itself. I think it's not at all, you know, unthinkable that something will change. For example, the leadership will come and say, you know, okay, this is the current path is not sustainable. We're going to do, say the religious establishment in Qom, you know, the major, you know, sort of center for all the theological seminaries in Iran, and they may decide as a whole, you know, that you know, I should point out that the revolution and according to its founding member Ayatollah Khomeini, there was always this popular element. I mean, Iranian constitution combines elements of theocracy with democracy. Elections have been meaningful so far. People have taken their votes very seriously. The spirit of democracy is very much alive in Iran. It's not something that was invented yesterday. It's indigenous. It's been there since at least the Constitutional Revolution of 1905. So one thing the revolution has had so far has been this, at least the office of leadership has been kind of removed from some shenanigans of this kind, on this kind of scale. Moreover, there's always been this popular and populist sort of bent to it. Now, there is no pretense to all that anymore. On that note, we no longer have a republic. We're moving toward what's called Islamic government instead of Islamic republic. So if the, you know, especially the religious establishment wants to maintain any semblance of legitimacy in the name of Islamic anything, especially if it's a republic, they may have to rethink all this. I mean, let's not forget they can remove, we have entities within the government that can remove and reappoint, you know, a different supreme leader who might make a different recommendation. It's possible, though at this point, you know, I don't see it without, there's a particular impasse. And right now, even within the very, a lot of conservatives, you know, in Iran have expressed outrage at the way the government has been reacting. And that, you know, when you have a good portion of the population convinced that that there has been, you know, irregularities and cheating and the election stolen, you just can't, you know, tell them be quiet, you know, or else. That's what essentially the Supreme Leader did.
Let's go to another call before we run out of time. Anne from La Crosse, hi.
Hi. You were talking a little bit about what I was curious about, but it appears, at least, and certainly I think President Obama made a comment, although I don't agree with all of his comments, but he made a comment that, you know, it didn't really matter, in essence, which one of the two candidates became president, because in reality, it's the clerics who are going to run what's happening in Iran. So I guess the question is there anything about the current revolutionary kind of mode that makes anyone think that this is really going to be an uprising that somehow changes that whole theocratic rule? It's pretty clear that the Republican Guard is going to take their orders from the clerics.
Yes, I think you meant Revolutionary Guard. That's part of what I was talking about. We've reached a point where the leadership has to decide: should it respect the will of the, you know, majority of people, a lot of conservatives included, who are not happy with, you know, where Mr. Ahmadinejad, you know, stands. During the elections, he came under blistering attacks. I mean, from conservatives such as Mr. Rezaei, who himself, one of the candidates, was the head of, you know, Revolutionary Guard, and he was basically ridiculed for not only his dangerous rhetoric. I mean, it's universally in Iran by most politicians. It's recognized that this Holocaust-denying, you know, sort of rhetoric has essentially been a blow to the dignity of Iranian people. And that it's hurt our standing in the world, and that our people, you know, don't deserve such kind of, you know, leadership. So obviously, I think that I should point out that President Obama has been, I think, very smart, and has been listening to the experts who tell him that's exactly where he should be, where he is, you know, and by emphasizing justice, which is a big, you know, sort of pillar of Islamic thinking, if the Islamic Republic's supreme leader is perceived not to be just, he is not qualified to be that. So, on that note, it does make a difference who is in the office, as we see, you know, what's going on in the country right now. If it didn't, people wouldn't be going to voting booths. At the end of the day, though, yes, I think it's the leadership at the top that has to decide.
On that note, we have to say goodbye. Thank you very much, Professor Mehdi Samati, our guest, and he's at the Department of Communication Studies, Eastern Illinois University, editor of Media, Culture, and Society in Iran, Living with Globalization and the Islamic State. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Rob Schroeder for on-air production as well, and we also want to thank Mohammed Abdul Dayem from the Committee to Protect Journalists. This is the Ideas Network.